11 Residency interview questions and answers. This is a very unique video because I will be interviewing one of our experts who will provide excellent answers to the commonly asked residency interview questions. So I'll be asking 11 questions, he will be providing his answers, and then we're gonna actually have a discussion about these questions and how to tackle them. Also, at the end of this video, I'll be sharing with you free access to our interview preparation guides that you can get fully for free. Before we get started, make sure to check out the interview preparation services we have. I'll leave the link in the description below. 100% satisfaction guarantee. Our experts are in top-notch residency programs. And now, let's get started. Hello, good morning, James. Welcome to our program.
Yes, yeah, thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome. Can we start by having you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is James Fisher. I'm a fourth-year medical student at the University of Pittsburgh. A little bit about me. You know, I have a strong blue-collar background, born and raised in the city of Pittsburgh, did all of my training at the University of Pittsburgh. You know, I've kind of had a, I guess, an affinity for science and medicine for my whole life. And actually, when I was kind of deciding what I was going to do for undergrad, ended up going into the engineering because it just kind of seemed like the perfect balance of all of these aspects. And it was kind of during my tenure in engineering that I got exposed to biomedical research. And that kind of led to some clinical shadowing opportunities and kind of was the impetus for me deciding to pivot from pursuing a career in engineering to pursuing a career in medicine. You know, as I went along, I realized that I kind of liked both equally as much. And that was what led me to pursue a combined MD-PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. There, I gained my initial exposure to plastic surgery throughout the lab. And then again, that led to more shadowing experiences and exposure to the field. And it was kind of like, you know, the perfect fit for me. So here I am today. I'm just really excited to be interviewing with everybody and really impressed with the program.
That's awesome. That's a very impressive background. Can you tell me a little bit about why are you interested in plastic surgery and what draws you to this specialty?
Yeah, so we know when I made the decision to pursue medicine, surgery was kind of what I always envisioned myself in. I didn't have a specific type of surgery, but I envisioned myself doing surgery. And as I spent more time in the lab, my initial collaborators were all cardiothoracic surgeons. So originally, when I matriculated, I saw myself being you know, a cardiothoracic transplant surgeon or a congenital heart surgeon. You know, that was kind of my initial thinking early on. And then, as I had alluded to before, when I started my PhD work, we began collaborating with the composite tissue allotransplantation group here at the University of Pittsburgh, which falls under the umbrella of plastic surgery. And my research mentor suggested that I spend some time shadowing him, doing you know, some larger head and neck free flaps just to see what it was that they did. And I'd never been exposed to any sort of free flap or major reconstructive surgery. And it was the most incredible thing that I'd ever seen. You know, the ENT surgeons completely resected a massive tumor from this older gentleman's face. And then the plastic surgeons came in and they used a bone from his leg to completely reconstruct his mandible. And I left there that day as I was kind of dumbfounded. I didn't realize that this sort of thing was happening in medicine. And I kind of knew that I needed to be a part of it. I did some further shadowing in pediatric plastic surgery, and then with our chair, who does a lot of body contouring surgery. And it just, again, it seemed like the perfect mix of technology and research and just innovation. And it just, it clicked. It all of a sudden clicked. I knew that this was the field that I could see myself thriving in.
You know, you're a great candidate, and we receive a lot of great candidates each year, hundreds of applicants, and we only have 2 spots at our program. What makes you stand out from other applicants, and how can you convince me to choose you for our residency program?
Certainly. And I've met several of the other applicants here today, and I agree. They are all equally, if not more impressive than me on paper. The intangibles that I possess, I think, are, you know, my sense of maturity. You know, I've spent a considerable amount of time in the laboratory, and you know, I think that with that brings a sense of maturity that I will be able to bring to the residency program, especially working in large teams, which we do often. I think that I have a level-headed sense about myself. I think with my research background as well, I'm used to working with a very diverse group of people. Oftentimes, these people have different interests at mind, but I think that I've done a good job in my research career thus far, managing different personality types, managing different interests, so that we can all kind of combine and work to the same common goal. And I think that that's going to serve me really well in residency and even beyond.
That's awesome. Now, talking about weaknesses, every one of us has certain areas that we identify as a weakness. What would others describe as your weaknesses?
I think my biggest weakness is my inability to say no, and I'm working on improving that. I think that I think we have a tendency to want to say yes to everything, and I think that you need to do that. But every time that you're saying yes, you're diluting your time and you're threading yourself a little bit thinner. And I think that I need to be more comfortable either saying no to things that I know that I just don't have the time to do, or I can't do well, or if I'm going to say yes, I need to get better at delegating tasks and being comfortable delegating tasks and letting someone else do it, whether it's a graduate student, a medical student. As I progress, throughout residency, being comfortable letting junior residents and interns do things, knowing that I can't do everything myself, but I can certainly oversee things, and I can have lots of different moving parts that, I'm controlling from afar.
And that's a weakness that we all have, we have a lot on our plates, and it's an art to know how to delegate tasks to the right people and make sure that they still do a good job while giving certain tasks to someone else. I'm still trusting that they will do a good job. Why do you want to train here?
I think that your program, first of all, they have a storied reputation of training leaders and thought leaders and innovators in the field. You look at the alumni, and it's a who's who of department chairs, program directors, and just accomplished individuals. So I think that that's an important thing. Looking at a program's track record and their history, and who they've trained in the past. Even in the most recent history, looking at your recent graduates and the fellowships that they've matched at, they all do very well matching at a variety of fellowship programs, be it in aesthetic surgery, craniofacial surgery, reconstructive microsurgery. So I know that I'm going to have my options open to me, if and when I decide on a fellowship. And also the innovative curriculum. Your program has always been kind of at the forefront for dictating training and education in plastic surgery. And I think that that's I think it's attractive to every applicant in the country. And I fall into that category, obviously.
That's awesome. Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
That's a great question. I think. I definitely see myself running a large, competitive basic science translational laboratory. I think that we'll have significant federal funding from the NIH and the DOD, as well as funding from industry. Clinically, I'm still a bit undifferentiated, but I remain open to options. I think that I think additional clinical training, fellowship training, is something that I see myself doing, especially because I see myself staying in academia, and I think that kind of is a stamp of approval that is becoming more and more important. If I had to choose right now, I would say it would be between general reconstructive surgery versus aesthetic components. But again, I remain somewhat undifferentiated, and I look forward to completing electives and my required rotations in those particular fields throughout the next several years to kind of figure out clinically what it is I wanted to do.
And if we're able to get you here, we'll be more than happy to support your goals of pursuing your research and your clinical interests. I've seen that you published a lot of, good clinical and basic science projects. Which of these stands out to you, or you would consider the most influential, or the one that you are proud of the most?
Certainly, yeah. I would say that it was our publication in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that looked at a cocktail of controlled release microspheres that were able to induce naive T cells towards a regulatory FOXP3 positive phenotype. You know, this was kind of one of the first projects that I started in my thesis, and it was a project that the concept actually was developed by the graduate student who had started prior to me in the lab, and this was kind of one of the first point of concepts of actually demonstrating that this theoretical cocktail is something that could work in a preclinical clinically relevant model. And we used it in the context of composite tissue transplantation, more specifically hind limb transplantation in a rat model. I'm really proud of this because this just was a lot of hard work. We had to do, I mean, over 100 hind limb transplants. That's a lot of man hours for microsurgery. It required me going in every day for each individual animal to give it a daily dose of tacrolimus. It required me, like, you know, dealing with rats trying to bite me. So I have the scars to prove that, and fighting, you know, with my family and others about why I couldn't leave the city because I had to monitor my rats. So it really was a labor of love. And we were able to demonstrate something, I think, clinically very powerful as well at the end. So the hard work paid off. And it's something that I think at the time it may have made me a little bit miserable, but I look back on it now and it was, I think it was all worth it.
And that all speaks to your amazing determination to get things done. Now I want to move on to ask you a few behavioral questions. Tell me about the situation where you had a misunderstanding with one of the team members during your clinical rotations. And how did you handle that?
Certainly. I would say it was less of a misunderstanding and more of a poor communication among a number of people. And it was during one of my sub-eyes in plastic surgery. There were a number of us who were assigned to kind of the same hospital, but there were multiple teams, and it was almost kind of left up to us to figure out who would be covering what cases and you know, who would be on what particular service. And it got further complicated by the fact that we all had different start times and different end times, but we all had to give a presentation on an interesting case at the end. So everybody was kind of fighting over certain cases because they wanted to present that case. And myself and two other sub-eyes came on at the same time, and we actually knew each other from conferences and from the interview trail. And we like got together and said, look, we need to have a meeting with the other four sub-eyes. So there were seven of us, which was kind of a lot. And we just need to figure out a way to make this work so that there's equity for everybody, and that we can kind of, you know, in a sense, triage the people who need to present sooner rather than later. And the people who have a little bit of, you know, we're starting our first week, so we don't necessarily need to get those interesting cases. We're going to have three weeks or so to figure that out. And, you know, I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. I was expecting it to be a little more contentious than what it was, but we kind of sat down and we made things work. We didn't have to get the chief resident involved. We didn't have to get anybody involved. We handled it ourselves. And the real thing that we talked about was that, look, we're all going to be colleagues together in the future, in the short future. And this is a small field, and we don't want to reflect back and be like, oh, when I worked with Jim at my sub-eye, he was being a jerk and trying to hog all the cases. Like, you know, I wanted people to look back and realize even then that, you know, we were, you know, trying to each in our own way help each other. And I think that speaks to, you know, the leadership capabilities, at least of myself and the other two individuals who came on that really spearheaded this. And like I said, it all worked out in the end, and we all gave great presentations, and I think we all got interviews at that place as well. So
awesome. That's a great way to handle the situation. Now tell me a little bit about a stressful situation that you went through, and how did you overcome that challenge?
Certainly. Probably, you know, the most challenging or stressful, impactful, however you want to put it, situation was my first year of medical school. You know, my mother was sick for several years prior to that with colorectal cancer that eventually metastasized to her liver and lungs and eventually her brain. And, you know, she ultimately ended up passing away about a month and a half into my first year of medical school. And that was, it was, I mean, that by itself is a very challenging thing to deal with. But the fact that it happened, you know, so early on in medical school, I think that I was I was just really stressed about everything, trying to digest that, trying to figure out ways to, you know, take care of things around the house and how to pay bills that weren't in my name and crazy stuff like that. But also, like, you know, trying to, you know, study for my medical school exams. And I think early on, a pitfall that I particularly made was not reaching out and letting the people in the medical school know that I needed help. I was trying to kind of just keep my head down and kind of go through things. And really what I learned was that people are there to help you, especially in extenuating circumstances like that. In the medical school and graduate school and residency program, you need to rely on your support systems, both personally and professionally. And when I did that, everyone was reasonable. You know, everyone in my personal life was reasonable. Everyone professionally was reasonable and went out of their way to just try to make things as easy as possible. Not that there's a great way to do that, but they did, and I got through it. And it's something that I keep in the back of my mind when things get really tough. I reflect on that moment and recognize that I was able to get through that. And I also reflect on what I did then. And it's like, if you need help, you should ask for help because people will give you help.
So sorry for your loss. And this principle that you mentioned of seeking help is definitely want to live by, because in residency things will get tough and everyone will need help at some point. And you know, you seeking help is definitely the best thing to do rather than trying to fight something and not let people know about that.
Exactly.
Now tell me a little bit about the situation where you had to deal with an angry patient. All of us did at some point. And how did you handle that situation?
Certainly. I think the most difficult patient that I've encountered, at least in medical school, was a younger individual who came to our service when I was doing my acting internship in vascular surgery. It was over a holiday weekend, and I was taking call that Sunday night. It was like a Memorial Day holiday weekend. And I was me and the intern, and this gentleman came in with a otherwise younger guy. But he had a foot wound, and he was a complex patient from a social standpoint. You know, he had a history of homelessness and IV drug abuse, but he was fairly young. But he had this necrotic foot wound that was it was bad. It was incredibly malodorous. There were maggots in the wound, and he didn't want us to do anything. So I had to go in there and talk to him. I had to figure out a way to convince him to let me debride the wound. And he did that. He let us do that. But it was kind of just a fight with him after that. He I don't think he had great insight into his condition. And ultimately he went back several days later, and we were talking to him in the pre-op area, and we told him that we were going to have to probably pursue amputation to get source control. And he went ballistic and he tried to like attack me and the intern, and it wasn't that great. And I wasn't sure what to do, but I remember he eventually agreed to it, at least to another debridement before we would amputate him. And then after the surgery, I found him in the post-op area. And I went over and, I shook his hand and I talked to him, and I tried to explain to him that, you know, I was just, you know, I'm looking out for him, and this is in his best interest. And instead of kind of running away from that patient, I hovered. I went there, I would go visit him in his room a couple times a day. And eventually he understood that was the best case, best course of treatment for him. And, I remember when he discharged, he gave me a hug and said, you know, thank you for, you know, kind of coming by and just and explaining things to me. And he apologized for, trying to attack me a week earlier. And that kind of, that made me feel really good, actually. It made me realize that, you know, I think that I had a breakthrough, and I got through to this particular patient, and we were able to make the right decision for him.
You know, that's a great way of dealing with this situation. And we have to understand that healthcare providers, we deal with patients or people in their most stressful times. So I've encountered myself multiple patients who are the nicest people ever, but at certain points they get angry, they shout because they are in a very stressful situation. So just put yourself in their shoes as a resident, as a fellow, as an attending, and you'll be able to understand how to handle them very easily. Jamil, it was very, very nice talking to you. Do you have any questions for me to tell you anything about our program or anything I can answer for you?
Yeah. So I one of the things that I like to ask programs, and I think that I've already seen some examples in this program, but can you tell me of any changes in the past 2 to 3 years that the program has made either to their curriculum or to their didactics, but major changes that have been made that have been based on direct feedback from residents or resident initiatives?
Yeah, that's definitely a great question. We actually take our residency like very, very seriously. One of the major changes we made actually was changing the rotations. We had certain rotations that the resident did not feel were as educational. So we took these rotations out and used the resident time for something that they found to be more educational. The other change that we implemented is changing our call system. We felt that our residents were spread thin across multiple hospitals, and we hired multiple PAs to cover certain hospitals that were further away and use our residents for the hospitals that were closer to each other and decrease the call burden on our residents. And that reflected in huge improvement in their quality of life and work-life balance and ability to study for their cases, prepare, and just, you know, have fun in their free time. Any great other questions I can answer for you?
I think that's it. I've had a lot of great discussions so far with other attendees and certainly with the residents in the breakout rooms. It's really been an insightful afternoon.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Yep, likewise.
Bye-bye. Awesome. So Jim, that was a great, you know, interview. And I just want to take a little bit of time now to comment on some of the questions and get your expertise and insight for people watching this video on why you chose certain answer and why do you think we should answer certain questions in a certain way. Let's start with the tell me about yourself. That was a perfect answer. In my opinion, you touched base on everything that you should talk about as an applicant. You talked a little bit about your background, some fun facts about you. Then you went into your research, your background as an engineer and how that transition came into place. And I feel that you're telling me strength in every statement that you were talking throughout the story. So you're not telling me, oh, I'm a hard worker, I'm like a team player. You were just going through a lot of your qualities and your skills through that question in a very nice way, in a storytelling manner, that telling me about you, but also your strength. Can you give us how you thought about that question? How do you recommend people to answer that?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be different for everybody. You know, you need to focus on what is unique about your application. So like, you know, in this particular case, you know, I focused on what was unique about my application at the time when I interviewed, and that was that I was an engineer with a background, PhD, and there were not that many individuals applying into plastic surgery, at least applicants at that time, that had that same background. So that was kind of something that I leaned into because it was something that was different about my application, and I hammered that home even from the get-go. But again, it's going to be different for everybody. Some people will have a more unique social story or personal story. They may have a unique talent or skill set. They may have be like an accomplished pianist or something. All of these things, you just need to find what is unique about your application, and I think highlight that there. But I think you also have to kind of tell your journey. What I tell applicants when they're doing this is, you know, you want to keep it under 2 minutes. I don't know if mine was under 2 minutes there. When I was peak interview season, it was definitely under 2 minutes. But you want to keep it under 2 minutes because you don't want to just recite your whole application. And I oftentimes tell people, if you're struggling, type it out. Like it's in paragraph format. And then you practice that. You pretend you're an actor or an actress, and it is a script. And you just practice it every day until you're so sick of telling, you know, talking about yourself that you know that that's great, because then you're ready. When the interview starts, when you're the most nervous at the beginning of the interview, when they ask you to tell me about yourself, you have it memorized because you've been practicing it every day for the past 3 weeks. So that's the other key there. And then, you know, the last thing is, you know, you want to hit on your strengths, but you kind of want to give an overview of everything. You know, I tell people that if you are a research project, the tell me about yourself question is kind of like the abstract to the research project. You need to hit a little bit on everything. If you have a unique thing, like I don't have any like super unique hobbies, so I didn't mention anything in there. But like, if you have a really unique hobby, you can mention that. Or if you have a husband and wife, or a wife and children, you can mention that at the end. Those are all fair game questions for the tell me about yourself. It's anything that you want the interviewer to know.
Awesome. That is an awesome summary for an extremely important question. And I highly recommend everyone to prepare very well, because that's going to be
probably most important question, because it's one of the only questions that you know you will be asked. So you might as well be able to kill it.
And usually it's asked at the beginning of the interview, and you're most stressed at the beginning of the interview. It'd be like easy transition to go in the flow.
Yep.
The other important question is, what are your strengths? And you answered that again in a perfect manner. You provided examples, not just words about you and abstract things. You actually provided me with some examples that can tell me about these strengths. What are your comments about that question, how people should approach the, especially the show not tell situation?
Exactly. I mean, you need to think about this critically, because it is a personal question. But, you know, you're applying to medical residency, you've went to medical school, you have strengths, you have certain, what I don't like to use the word strengths. I like to use the word intangibles, because That's what you're mentioning. You're mentioning something specific about yourself that is inherent to your own personality, that is not on your application. Your application is a reflection of those intangibles. So you need to say, like, what is it that you bring to the table that is unique, that is going to make you thrive in that program? And it needs to be specific, and you need to be able to back it up with experiences. The thing that everybody says, and it drives me nuts, and people will say it to me moving forward, is I'm a hard worker. It's like everybody's a hard worker. We're all hard workers. Or I'm smart. I'm intelligent. It's like, well, I mean, we're all kind of smart. We've made it this far. You need to be more specific than that. And you need to, and everybody out there that's watching this, that is applying, you have something unique about yourself that is an intangible skill that is desirable to a residency program. You need to figure out what that is. It just needs a little bit of introspection and thinking about what has allowed you to succeed thus far.
100%. And, you know, that's why I tell people, took me hours to prepare for interviews, because you have to dig kind of in yourself and see what are the things that you have and how you actually tailor it to the program. Some programs you might not need to mention your research as a strength, because that program doesn't have much research. You as a basic science man and like PhD, probably research is not high on the list compared to other things. So you have to kind of tailor your answer and your strength based on the program and what they offer, so you can see yourself or offer yourself as a fit for what they have.
Yep.
Fitness was another, you know, great answer that you provided, because I feel that people sometimes provide the weakness that is, you know, look bad and would not make them good as a residency candidate. Like one applicant one time told me, oh, I get angry sometimes on patients. I was like, oh, wow, that's like, that's not good. Sometimes, you know, you have people that say, I pay attention to details. That's my weakness, which is, you know, you're trying to cover a strength of the weakness. How did you approach that question? I think the answer saying no is actually, you know, it's a weakness that you can work on. You've mentioned some things. How do you approach the weakness? And what advice do you have for people when answering that question?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. And this is interviewing 101. This is not unique to medical residency interviewing. Everyone will ask you the tell me a weakness question. And it's like, you need to come up with a weakness that's kind of a strength. But yeah, I agree. You don't want to give them like a true weakness, like, oh, I sleep in all the time and I'm late to rounds. Like that's keep that to yourself. But you need to come up with something, I think, that is something that you can improve upon. And again, it's something that you need to think about. And I had to think about this, like, what is a true weakness of mine? And when I thought about it, it was like probably time management. But I didn't want to say time management, because that still kind of sounds like a real weakness. So how can I make it seem less negative and more positive? And I thought, what is the root cause of some of my time management issues? And it's that I'm overextending myself. I say yes. I'm conditioned to say yes to everything, and I'm conditioned to do everything myself. And, you know, how do I address that? Well, A, I can say no, which, you know, you just may have to do at some point, and be comfortable saying yes to certain things that you know that you can accomplish, and no to things that you can't. And delegation, which is the key. You know, the more you advance in any field, I mean, you know, you need to be more comfortable managing people than managing direct problems.
Exactly. I loved your answer about why the specialty, because you provided, you know, stories of kind of stages of how that interest developed. And this is how usually the case. You don't just like see one patient, I'm like, want to do that specialty. How do you recommend answering the why interested in the specialty?
Again, it's very personal. You know, for me, that was one of the easier ones to come up with once I realized what I was doing. For the longest time, you know, I told people I was like this engineer, MD, PhD, who wanted to be a surgeon, wanted to run his own lab and have context between the lab and his research and his clinic. And I was saying all of that. I was saying all these buzzwords. And in the back of my mind, I was like, I have no idea how I'm actually going to do this. I just assumed that it would come together at some point. And it kind of did. It came together in a sense that I, you know, was able to, you know, I spent some time shadowing a research collaborator. And I got exposed to these types of surgeries that I didn't even know existed. And then I got exposed even further to the field because I, you know, got a little bit of interest, but they were like, oh, well, if you like this, why don't you see what's going on in you know, the pediatric realm? Why don't you see what's going on in the body contouring realm? And then I saw other individuals there who were running their own laboratories, who had active research programs, who were doing exactly what I wanted to do. And that was like, was like, I found my peers. I found what I needed to do. And it was like, honestly, it was such a relief for me when I did that, because I was like, I finally know how I'm going to put all of these pieces together. Because before that, I was just like talking and hoping. And as you know, hope is not a strategy. So
definitely. Before we move on to commenting on behavioral questions, the question of why do you want to come here? That's a very important question. Sometimes you get asked about that and people answer it in a very vague, generic way. You approach it to talk about specifics about the program. Sometimes you use it as a way to express your strength by saying, I have this and this is what you offer and that's why we're a good fit. Can you comment on that question of why the program?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, again, this setup is a bit contrived because it's you know, we're not doing it for a specific program, but I'm saying all of the things that you would say about a specific program. And the more specific you can be, the better. At the very least, you should go and look at the program's website, look at the program leadership, look and see what their clinical interests are, what their research interests are, look at the program's, you know, curriculum, see if there's anything unique about it. And those are all of the things that you need to you know, kind of have in the back of your mind when you're answering that question, because you want to be as specific as possible. If you can say like, yes, you know, I'm familiar with the changes to the clinical curriculum that were made by Dr. Smith 3 years ago, and that's part of his research and graduate medical education. It's something that I'm really passionate about too. And I look forward to working with him to kind of optimize. The more specific you can be, the better. The worst thing you can do is say something very generic or make it look like you didn't do your research. And I think that's what most programs want to know is, A, at the very least, did you do your research? And B, if it is truly, you know, your number one, two or three program, like, just explain why. Like, you know, you can be as effusive if you want. Talk about the city, talk about everybody there and how you just love everything that they're doing. You can be as extra as you want. It's totally fine. You just need to be honest.
Definitely. And now going to behavioral questions, these are kind of different questions, but they have the same theme, you know, problem background. You talk about the solution and kind of what you learned from it. And the way you answered these behavioral questions was really interesting, because the problem and how you dealt with it shows maturity on all the three questions I asked you. How do you recommend approaching these questions? Picking right stories, because sometimes I've seen people who pick stories that would not convey in a nice way. How do you approach behavioral questions in general?
I mean, again, it's, you know, there's no way to prepare for every single question that you're going to be asked on the interview trail. You will invariably be asked a question that is going to like leave you blank, and then you're going to talk about it for the rest of your life. I have a couple of them, or things that you're asked to do, but you need to just practice, you know, like on the Match Guy website, you guys have like the 200 commonly asked questions, and you can look elsewhere on the internet. These questions are out there. And again, these are not necessarily even unique to medical residency. This is interviewing 101. These are behavioral questions that can be phrased and formulated or tailored to any sort of application. But they want to see, like, you know, an ethical situation, you know, working in conflict. You know, tell me a time that you worked under pressure and how you, you know, what you did. So you need to think about these questions and think about, you know, an example. Like we've all had to deal with a time where we worked under pressure. We've all had conflicts. We've all had, you know, especially in medicine, you've had ethical problems, or even in research. I mean, you're working with people. Everybody has different interests, and these things arise. So some people struggle, and I think that ideally, if you can come up with answers to these questions that are clinically oriented, that's great. But even if you can't, if it's something to do with a research experience that you had or a volunteer experience, you know, it doesn't really matter. It just needs to show that you can think about these questions. You know how to come up with solutions, and how the solutions that you have come up with are going to serve you well as a resident.
Exactly. They're all trying to see how you would handle situations that might come up with a residency, working with a team, being a leader, working with patients. So you have to reflect something that this is what a reasonable resident would do. I myself was preparing a lot of people for interviews. You've done a ton of interview prep with applicants. Why do you think people need that? Because I feel a lot of people don't understand the value of interviews and how interviews are important, how a mistake on that can, you know, be detrimental to their chance of residency. And they don't think that they need interview to start with. From working with so many people, why do you think people actually need prep with someone who knows what they're doing and how the advice that they give them regarding interviews?
I mean, it's like anything. You need practice and you need repetitions. You know, with interviews, it's not something that people have a lot of practice doing. You know, you do it maybe when you're getting into medical school, and then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, in my case, several years later, you know, you do it again with residency, and things change. The types of questions that you're asked change. You as an applicant and as a human change. But I think that you need to, I think the repetition, the feedback from someone who knows what a good or a bad answer is key. You need to practice. You can practice you want all your on your own all you want, but if you're doing the wrong thing and you're not getting the appropriate feedback, then you're just reinforcing bad behaviors and something that you necessarily don't want to reinforce. So it's about repetitions, it's about feedback, and it's about practice. The more you do it, the more comfortable you're going to do it, even if you're doing it with the same person. Just answering the questions, just thinking about things, kind of brainstorming oftentimes after the interview with that person about how could I have done this better? You know, I think all of that stuff is really important, especially, you know, I mean, this is high stakes, very high stakes. So you don't want to screw things up. And, you know, as you go on throughout the interview process, you're going to get better and better. So people who are interviewing right, you know, now in October and November, you know, your first interview is probably going to be your worst interview. In my case, my first interview was with Harvard because they were the first people to offer interviews like for the plastic surgeons. And we were all, me and all the applicants were like super nervous. It was like, you know, the middle of November. And we're like, this is like, you know, A, it's the first interview because, you know, we're nervous. And B, it's at Harvard. So it's like super intimidating. You know, so like, you know, being prepared going into that is super important, you know, and as you go along, you're going to get practice at the interviews. You're going to know when things go good and when things go bad. And then you're going to get practice just practicing on your own. So, you know, come January and even February, you're like a pro at that point, but you want to be able to really do well in those early interviews. When you may be a little bit rusty, when you're nervous, when you don't know what to say, when you haven't experienced all of the possible scenarios and questions that can be thrown at you.
Yeah, funny enough, my actual first interview was at Harvard too.
They're one of the early birds for our program. So
yeah, and I highly agree with the idea of how high stake this is. You know, you've studied a ton, you've done your step one, step two, rotations, a lot of things. This is the chance of you really leaving a good impression. And a lot of programs, once you get an interview, I know that not all programs believe in that, but a lot of programs, once you get an interview, almost all applicants are on the same stage. Your performance decides.
Everything is thrown out at that point. People tell me they're, oh, I wish I could have done better on step one. And it's like, it doesn't matter. You are at the interview now. Your application is going to be discussed when they are making a rank list. Again, this is, you know, I'm sure there are exceptions, but most places, if they had consternations about your scores or anything that you could change on your application, they would not have sent you an interview. The fact that they want to take a look at you, and you're going to be discussed and you're going to be ranked unless you bomb the interview. More reason to be prepared for it, though.
It's your time to shine out. And you mentioned a good point. You know, you talked about how you interview for med school, interviews for college, and a lot of international graduates don't interview for anything. You know, you go to med school based on a score, you go to anything based on certain scores, and you don't have the practice of doing an interview to get a job. That's why I highly recommend for applicants and specifically international graduates to do interview prep, even if it's 1 hour, just like do make sure that things are good. It's definitely worth it, and it's a whole investment in your future. Not matching for a year is like a loss of an attending salary, and it's a huge, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you need help with the interview preparation, I'll leave the link for our interview preparation packages, and all our interview preparations is 100% refundable. If you're not satisfied after the first hour, you're not happy, we send you your money back. Jim, the final thing that I asked you, do you have any questions for me? That's generally a question asked at the end of each interview. How do you answer that, or how do you ask that question? And what is a good question? What is a bad question?
So, you know, I think that the key there is that you actually ask questions. And it's going to be different. You may have actual questions that come up when the program director gives their talk at the beginning of the interview, when residents say certain things in the breakout rooms, it may, like, you know, something may pop off in your mind and you may want to follow up on that. those are, you know, legit questions that you have that you're curious about something that you heard, those are always fair game. Any questions that you have about the program that you've done in your research is fair game. But the bottom line is, at a lot of these programs, a lot of these interviews are long. You're going to be interviewing with six, seven, you know, at the University of Pittsburgh, you know, we're notorious. It's like literally all day. You interview with every faculty member. We have like 14 faculty members. It's a long day. So when you get to the end of the interview process, you're just like emotionally drained. And you're like, oh, it's 5 o'clock. We're going to go get a nice dinner somewhere. And they're like, do you have any questions for us? And you don't have any questions because you've heard everything that you could hear about this program. You need to have canned questions that you should ask these programs, because you want them to seem interested and engaged. And it sounds kind of silly, but you just need to have one or two semi-generic questions that you could literally ask any program director, any faculty member that are articulate. The one that I like, and this is the question that I asked, is a question that I asked all of my programs because I think it's a good question. Have you changed your curriculum? Or what, you know, every program gets feedback from residents, but like, have you actually done anything based on that feedback from residents? And, you know, some places will tell you, you know, they'll give you very specific examples, and some places will give you generic examples. And it's kind of like, you know, again, the interview is a two-way street. So they can tell when you're giving them an answer that like is questionable, and you will be able to tell when they're giving you an answer that's questionable, and you should remember that, or maybe they give you a really good answer. But regardless, you need to remember that when it comes time to make the rank list. Those are, you know, things that you need to keep in mind. But I would say at least have one or two generic enough questions that you could ask anybody. I wouldn't really necessarily say more than that because you're probably going to run out of time. I can only think of one. There was one interview in particular that I tell everybody about. I won't name the institution, but I sat down and the interview started out with, they're like, oh, it's great to have you here, Jim. What questions do you have for us? And then that went on for 20 minutes. And by the end, I like wasn't even listening to what they were saying. I was trying to think about my next question. So that's kind of the extreme. But you should have at least one or two questions. And again, you may have legit questions that come up unique to each program when you hear the talks by the program directors, et cetera.
Yeah, and try to not ask questions that you can find online or they just answered in the session in the morning, because that means that you're not listening or you're not doing your research.
Exactly.
Jim, that was a phenomenal interview, a phenomenal discussion about the interview process. Any final advice you have for people listening to this video preparing interviews?
You know, I think practice the questions you know that you're going to be asked. Practice the tell me about yourself question, practice why the subspecialty you're applying to, and practice why that particular program. You know you will be asked those questions. Whether or not you're going to be asked what your spirit animal is, I don't know. You know, something weird like that. But practice the questions that you know you're going to be asked. And the last piece of advice I give people is, if you have a bad interview, you need to forget about it. Or if you think that the interview went poorly, you need to forget about it. And you need to move on to the next interview. Sometimes these interview rooms are designed to be pressure rooms, and everybody has a bad interview. Things are a little bit different now in the COVID era because you don't interact with the applicants as much. But pre-COVID, when I was applying, almost 99% of the time when I left a room and I thought that things went poorly, I would go to like the coffee station and I would be talking to the other applicants. And they would be like, oh, you came from that room. And I would be like, yeah. And they would be like, that was really weird. Did they do this? Did they look at you that way? And I'm like, yeah, they did. And they're like, that was crazy. Like, so, you know, you need to forget about that and you need to go on to the next room and just, you know, keep chugging along.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fisher, for this extremely insightful video and valuable advice to those interviewing this cycle. Remember, if you need help with your interview preparation, our advisors are ready to help you. We have top-notch advisors who trained at the top residency programs in the US, who went through the process, have tutored multiple students with interview preparation, and I trust my advisors so much that I made the interview preparation 100% satisfaction guarantee, which means if you are not happy after the first hour, we either assign you to another advisor or you get your money back. Also, now it's time to share with you the free guide I promised you at the beginning of this video. To get this guide, either click on the card above or the link in the description below, and you'll be prompted to put your email and name, and then within a few minutes you'll get the guide in your email. If you find any value in this video, I would really appreciate it if you hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and share this video with your friend who's also applying, because that can help support me and support the channel to keep making videos like this to support you throughout your journey. And wait, before you go, there's still another video that you can watch to help you ace your residency interview. It's a full tutorial that I recently recorded and you can watch it by clicking here. Thank you everyone so much for watching and good luck on your interview. Thank you.